So it's a pleasure to be here, and thanks for coming out. I see you're much like undergraduates. Everybody's in the back row, except a couple of star students up front. I thought I was supposed to do this strictly by working on a blackboard. And so I prepared this to work on the blackboard only. And then I realized I just couldn't do some of the sketches. And then furthermore, I'm, as David said, I'm a member of the Cassini imaging team, and I just couldn't really bring myself to talk about Saturn's rings and not show at least a few slides or pictures.
You have an exception.
Oh, okay. But philosophically, this is supposed to be a blackboard talk. So interrupt it, and let's. My goal here is to try to tell you how disks operate using Saturn as an example. And use some very simple high school physics, college physics, to try to at least give you a sense of how this system, the Saturn system, evolves. So the Saturn system, as we know, is, you know, like the wonder of the solar system. You ask most kids sketch something up in the sky, you'll get 9 times out of 10, you'll get them sketching a ring system, which of course makes me feel good since I like rings a lot. But probably many of you started out your careers in physics sketching ring systems, and so you're all astrophysicists and all experts going back decades in the solar system physics anyway. Saturn, as you know, is out about 10 times as far from the sun as the Earth is. It's surrounded by a magnificent ring system. And the ring system is made up of innumerable particles ranging in size from seashells up to surfboards, something like that. And they orbit in a disk that's confined to maybe twice the radius of Saturn, roughly. The dynamics of that system is governed by mutual collisions, self-gravity in the disk itself. We know something about the composition of the rings. They're made up of almost exclusively water ice, probably condensed from way back when. We don't exactly know the origin. There are several theories of the origin. But the reason I'm interested in Saturn's rings what I'd like to try to do today is to place it in a bigger context. I'd like to talk about how we can use Saturn's rings. Remember, we've got a spacecraft in orbit around Saturn's rings, and how we can use that spacecraft to try to understand some of the processes that are going on around other places in the universe. You know, whether it be galaxies or accretion disks around black holes. Maybe their physics is a little bit different, but much of it is the same. So what exactly is going on in that system? Some of the physics might be a little different here because of the presence of gas. That's an important pressure force. But much of it is the same. You've got, in each case, a flattened system, a system where the central mass is dominant. In the case of the Saturn system, Saturn's rings only are a millionth or much less than that, maybe, of the mass of Saturn itself. So what's going on? How long? The sorts of questions that people ask in the case of protoplanetary disks, and you've seen this in the discussions of extrasolar planets now. Just on Friday, there was a seminar talking about we're now up at almost 300 extrasolar planets. How long do the disks survive in those systems? What happens with the embedding of a massive mass? How does it open a gap? Can we get some idea of the time scale? And in the case of protoplanetary disks, we're looking at systems through a very, very fuzzy telescope. I mean, much of our knowledge is done by inference, not by actually seeing what's going on. Right? You say, we even heard it the other day, well, we've got these hot Jupiters in there. They're in at a few solar radii. We understand that as an interaction with the disk. We do, but we don't. I mean, you know, if you go back to when when these hot Jupiters were first discovered, there were 12 different theories out there. Everyone had their own idea. Now the weight of the evidence and the weight of the popular opinion is that they are done by evolution with the disk, but it's, again, largely by inference. We can barely see gaps in a few of the disks. So how are particles pushed around? How long do those disks survive? Because we need to see whether or not our models are adequate in being able to produce planets within those systems over the times that we think the disks survive. That sort of discussion that I'd like to do today. And I'd like to tell you a little bit about some of the images that we get back from the Cassini spacecraft. We've got a very capable spacecraft in orbit around Saturn. We've been there approaching 4 years now. We're hoping the mission is nominally to end this summer, but some of us are still spry and have publications in our blood yet, so we're hoping NASA will extend this for at least 4 more, maybe even 6 more years. And when you get out to a stream of about 10 years, you're starting to be able to actually see some of the evolution in the system, we hope. And so we can really tie down some of the numbers. We have, aboard the spacecraft, we have a series of imaging devices, not only visual cameras, but infrared cameras, radio signals that we send through the ring system. We've got ultraviolet sensors, plasma sensors, magnetic fields, magnetometers, lots of very capable things. And one of the things we do, in addition, is we send radio signals, as I say, through the rings, and that allows us to get very precise measurements of the structure of the rings, down to 10 meters or something. You know, from here to the wall, we can say what the optical depth, how much material is in the way, and what the particle size distribution is. So we have a very capable spacecraft, and how can we make use of that?
Everything still works at the end of the spectrum?
Most everything works. You can go on the Cassini webpage weekly, and they say the spacecraft is still in excellent condition of health. I wouldn't talk to the people on the magnetometer team, but, you know, or maybe by phone or email. You don't talk to them in person. They're sort of bitter individuals there. But anyway, so let me just show you a few slides now, I hope. And I've been having computer problems, so I hope you bear with me. I'm going to put up down this one, David, all the way on the far end, don't I? Leave me. So one of the events that happened to me while I was here a couple of weeks ago is that my third disk crashed totally. And so I'm now operating on borrowed time. So virtually all the images that I show you will be ones that we've taken with the imaging system. And
That's a real image.
Unbelievable. Another real image. So here's my rough description of the talk, I hope. And I'm going to try and fit them into these 4 panels. We'll see if that works. If not, I've got an extra panel. And I can always pull up the screen, too, so we'll see. This was the point I tried to make already, that namely, when we look at Saturn's rings here, we're seeing a flattened disk. We're seeing something like the disk, the first disk that was discovered around another star, Beta Pic. Now I've got much better images of this. But you get the same idea of a flattened system with a central body, a massive central body. In the case of the protoplanetary disk, these dimensions tend to be more like 10% or something like that. The mass in the disk might be 10% of the central mass. Saturn's system is a much more extreme case. And in the case of galaxies, also flattened disks, again, same processes going on. The only difference here is that the mass in the central core is perhaps roughly equal to the mass in the disk surrounding it. But we have an opportunity, as I say, to look and actually take movies, if you like, of this, the evolution of this system. And I'll try to give you some clue as to that in a moment. And we'll be talking about a variety. Yes?
So how much of the angular momentum in the system is in the core, and how much is in the disk?
In the case of the Saturn ring system, because it's so little mass, essentially nothing to me. You know, the mass in the disk again is 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 6 of the central mass. And the it's comparable maybe that if you would have compressed the whole thing, you'd have a body which is maybe 150 kilometers across or something like that. So a small satellite would make up the ring. We'll get to that in a second. Part of my surprise, yeah. So here are some of the classically named, not very, I think we need a writer, Jennifer, if you want to work. We have the A ring and the B ring separated by what was thought at one time to be an empty gap, the so-called Cassini division, and a much less extensive inner ring called the C ring. We'll specialize and spend a little bit of time looking at this hole in the system called the Encke gap. And those who have real good eyes can see there's another one right out here at the outer edge called the Keeler gap. We'll look at an image of that. Because they're embedded in each of those are little moons. And so we have the same thing going on there that we think is going on in the case of protoplanetary disks. And that's part of the interest. And I wrote, just to remind myself, you already know there's dynamics going on in this system. Because if I look at this outer edge of this, the most massive of the rings, it sits at a 2-to-1 resonance with one of the major satellites, Mimas. That is, particle at the outer edge there goes around twice. I'm sorry, goes around twice for every one time that this satellite goes around Mimas. Oh, it sounds like dynamics. Similarly, the outer edge here, a particle goes around 7 times for every 6 times of another satellite goes around. More dynamics. So what's going on? And there are, as you, those who follow the extrasolar planet literature know, there are links between some of the satellites that you find in extrasolar systems links in the ratio of their orbital periods as well. So maybe we get a clue of that by looking at this. This is an image now of that gap, the Encke gap. It's 320 kilometers across. We saw this on an inbound leg. And again, you can see more dynamics. You can see very crisp edges. And it turns out when we do these occultation measurements, those edges, here you've got essentially 60, 70% of the surface area covered by material, by ice. Within 10 meters, boom, there's nothing. Nothing, absolutely clear. How does that happen? We see patterns that are driven by resonances, so-called density waves, driven by the satellites. We also see a wavy edge here, what's going on there. It's now known that there's a small satellite that sits in the middle of this gap, and that there's a narrow ring that runs along with that small satellite. It's a nice three-body problem for those who like classical mechanics. And there are other types of features within the system. So this is what we see in the Saturn system, and we can only imagine if that also is present in other systems.
So what's the exposure time on this sort of image?
Typical exposures we do in tenth of a second, something like that. We have a few, my specialty is very faint rings, things that reflect only maybe a millionth of the light that strikes them or something like that. And there we have to go up to 10 seconds maybe. We'll even go down to milliseconds in some of these exposures. Got an extraordinary imaging system by comparison to past things. You know, at present, right here, there's a batch of dust that sits in that system.
I hear that causes the ring.
The moon in the middle causes there is a moon that sits up here off the edge of the image. And that, we think, causes this gap. Mm-hmm. Okay?
And the variation in light on moon.
More and more. Well, give me a second, and we'll get to some of that.
Could you give us some idea how big the moon is and how wide the gap is?
The gap is, again, 320 kilometers.
Okay.
And the moon is about 10 kilometers across.
Oh, so it's only like from here to Los Angeles or something?
Yeah. Yeah. We see a ring system that has varying optical depths, and certainly one of the surprises is that there is so much structure in the ring system, and you saw some of that already. So now, after we get rid of these pretty slides, let me turn that off, and we're actually going to do a little bit of physics here now. You know, we're all interested, or at least many of us are interested in mechanics or celestial mechanics on the imaging team. So I just want to remind you, I've got to pull that screen up, people on the left. Screen up.
Left one.
One wonders, my wife would now say, yeah, you're the engineer, right? Now pulling up, the left screen goes up with the left button, right? Okay, so let me just remind you a little bit of orbital mechanics. Kepler told us that the orbits in the solar system are ellipses, so I could write an equation for that ellipse that looks like this. I measured the distance from the central body by r, the angle from the closest approach point by f. This equation looks like this. Some outer roundness, the eccentricity of this ellipse. Okay, and in most cases, in the solar system, E is very, very small. It's a measure of the fractional amount that the center of the ellipse is from the actual place where the central mass is. So in most cases, I can just write this as A 1 minus E cosine F. Okay, so that's our first equation. I've got a couple more I want to put in this section. Second equation I want to do is to remind you that I can compute, if this were on a circular orbit, and again, in most cases, we're pretty close to a circular orbit, so I can write out just a balance of F, you know, F equals ma, and write out that the centripetal acceleration, this is freshman physics, the centripetal acceleration, v squared over r for the velocity r at radius, velocity v at radius r, is going to be equal to the gravitational acceleration, which is Newton's law, Newton's universal gravitational constant, the mass of the central body divided through by r squared. Okay, and that immediately then allows me to write out what typical circular velocities are for such a body. You remember this, something like that. And in the case of objects in Saturn's rings, these are fairly substantial, at least by solar system standards, 30 kilometers a second, 20, 30 kilometers a second, something like that. So that's of some interest, and maybe I'll just even, well, I'll leave it to that. And another thing that we might be interested in is knowing if I had two objects on nearby orbits, say that differ from one another by some amount, or how much faster does the guy in closer go than the one out further? So I'm putting this guy, either say at radius r, this inner one is moving at v, the other one is moving at v plus delta v. What is delta v? Well, I can get that obviously by just taking a derivative of this and finding that delta v is, of course, 1/2 v delta r over r. Okay, there's this unit seem to be okay. And so as I drift out in a body, I'm going to get smaller and smaller velocities, and the velocity drops off like 1 over the radius. Okay? In other words, that if I look at the velocities, if I imagine myself in the central body here and I look at the speeds of my neighbors, what I'm going to find is a shear across this body. There'll be the guy in close moving faster, the guy out further moving more slowly than I am moving. And so I have a shear across myself, like so. So immediately you know in these disks that are fairly opaque, you immediately know that there are going to be collisions in this system. One guy is drifting past the other. It's much like collisions occur on the 101 or whatever. You're going to have people hitting one another, but they hit, if they're separated by only a little bit, they hit at relatively slow speeds. Okay, we'll compute that in a moment. Now another interesting quantity might be to ask myself, if I watch a particle, say, that's sitting, if myself and someone else on an inner orbit are aligned at some instant, if I come back one orbit later, how far apart are we? That is, how far has this particle moved relative to me in the course of a single orbit? Okay, and that's going to be, there are going to be two parts to that, of course, because the particle in here is moving faster than I am, and so in a single orbit, it gets around further, right, because it's moving at a higher speed. But there's another component to that, of course, and that is the fact that the track that I take is longer, like 2 pi delta r. Okay, so I have two things that are going to affect me, making the drift that occurs in an orbit. It's going to be given by the orbital period times the change in the difference in my velocity plus this, you know, 2 pi or minus 2 pi or I'm sorry, yeah, minus delta r.
Oops, what did I do?
2 pi r plus delta r. Okay, and if I do all that out, it turns out that the shift here is 3 pi delta r. Okay, just about this guy goes about a factor of 10 further along than the separation of the two bodies. Okay, so that's the orbital mechanics I want to do for the moment. I'll come back and do one other thing in a second, in 5 seconds. Don't allow that intrusion. So let's say a little bit now about the global structure. And this comes back to David's question about the thickness of the rings and an earlier question I had gotten about do these rings always lie in the equatorial plane of the planet or the ecliptic plane or something like that. keep in mind that Saturn is quite oblate. So that its radius, equatorial radius, is about 10% higher than its polar radius. And what that means is if I take an object, say I take a disk of material and I put that disk of material in at some angle relative to the equatorial plane, or you can look at a single spacecraft if you want or something like that. Anyway, if I have an angle like that, that orbit, the orbit of this guy, has an angular momentum associated with them like so. Okay, just usual mass times the linear or mass velocity and radius. And you see that the ends of this get tugged up by the oblateness here. No longer are you looking at a 1 over r squared force law, but you've got things pulling on the ends of the orbit, essentially. So what does that do? That moment that's being produced in this way causes the angular momentum vector to precess. Okay? Due to the oblateness, you see that in local spacecraft orbits. If you're as old as I am, and most of you aren't, but if you go back to Sputnik days, remember Sputnik's orbit drifted each night, so it came up in a different place in the sky. And how fast is that drift? If you were to do this experiment on Saturn, and we can compute an equation, but I won't today. You can come back in a month, and you won't have a single plane like this. You'll have a torus, and it occurs very, very rapidly. And, of course, in a torus like this, when I have an orbit that had been like that, a little while later, another orbit will be looking like that. So, just as this particle is coming up like so, this guy will be coming down. And there'll be a collision, or the possibility of a collision. Again, remember, you've seen the images. This is a pretty opaque disk. So you're going to lose that component of the angular momentum. Numerical experiments show this. You can argue it very easily and come up with expressions. But over a very short period of time, you end up with your ring system in the equatorial plane.
You argued that starting from the idea of a disk, but if you have a sort of random circulation, does it also the same method?
Same process goes on. The only thing that really governs this is how opaque is the system. That'll tell you how long it takes, but it's inevitable. And it happens extraordinarily fast, in fact, in cases of that. So, then you say, well, David asked, how thick is the disk? People did experiments way back when of waiting until you look edge on of the rings from the ground, and you computed, we were able to compute, say, 20 years ago, that the ring was at least no more than a kilometer thick. Now that we've gone there, in fact, I told you the answer already, essentially, when we've gone there, we know the ring is 10 meters thick. How do we know that? Remember I said, you get a star passing behind the ring system, boom, it cuts off in 10 meters. If the thing were a kilometer thick, then you would have the possibility of a grazing occultation. You would see a gradual diminution of the light. You don't see that. It just stops. So it's 10 meters thick.
It's uniformly thick across the radially? It's the same?
Yeah, there are caveats on that. There are some of these structures I've shown you have crumples in them. And we're waiting very, very excitedly for a couple of years from now. We're going to be on the ring system is going to be edge on to the sun. And we'll be there. And we'll be able to see the shadows of these systems. That's going to be great. That's one part in 10 million, 100 million, something like that. So it's like taking a piece of tissue paper and spreading it across the entire campus. That's how thick the ring system is. Extraordinarily thin. So that's one comment on the structure, 10 meters thick. But of course, back to our discussion, in the case of galaxies or protoplanetary disks, you expect the same thing, right? Same process. May not go to completion, because in the case of Or, we like to say in Ithaca, in memory of Carl Sagan, these guys have gone around billions and billions and billions of times. Because, you know, the orbital period is only 5 hours or 6 hours, something like that. You get 5.5 billion years. So lots of opportunity for this system to flatten. In case of galaxies, a few orbits maybe, so the flattening is not so complete. But what else? Well, this, of course, gives you then a measure, the thickness gives you a measure of the random velocity, thermal velocity in the system. Right? Because if these guys were all bouncing around and weren't moving at the 30 kilometers a second, but were going, you know, slightly different than that, a little bit out of the plane, then you would see a substantial thickness. So you can compute what is the random velocity of the system. It's like 10 to, I don't know, 0.03 centimeters a second, something like that, compared to 30 kilometers. So this is, you know, the 101 to an extreme, right? Because everybody's going like a bat out of hell, and then there are these little gentle motions relative to that. What is another global thing? I could do this more completely. I won't, just for lack of time. But let me come back over here to this diagram.
Excuse me for a second. What's the size of the particle? What's the particle distribution size?
Typical size again, or centimeters up to 10 meters, something like that. So what you're getting is you're getting bouncing off these guys. And that probably is what's thermalizing the system. It's a granular flow.
And they grew up to that size, or they collided and smashed down to that size?
Not so clear. I mean, that's an interesting question I hope to get to. So the other aspect of this I wanted to mention is just, as I come back here, imagine, again, we'll do our little thought experiment with these two particles, but we're now going to make them bigger. They're the full 10 meters or whatever. What's going to happen, of course, is that as they move along together, this one will catch up and will be hit. Will hit, the interaction between those two particles. And what's going to occur in that interaction is there will be a force in that direction on the inner particle, right? He's running into it, he's getting hit. And there's going to be a force in that direction on the outer particle. You take energy away from this side, you add energy to that one. The consequence is the system spreads. And you can compute, you want to do a granular material thing, you can go back and compute a viscosity for this granular material. You have a certain amount of angular momentum in the system. You can compute a spreading time. Okay? So radial spreading is inevitable. And for the A ring to move into the B ring, it takes something like into the 8 years. The system supposedly has been around for 5 times 10 to the 9 years, as most people would say. So either this calculation is wrong, or the system's young, or there's other physics going on. And that's part of the reason we want to run this spacecraft in orbit, is to be able to look at that other physics. But you know immediately, again, there's other physics going on. Why is that? Because keep in mind, I said once more, boundaries are sharp. This collisional physics immediately tells you that you should have diffusion. Edges should be fuzzy. When Voyager 20 years ago, 25 years ago, got to Saturn, we expected to see a featureless ring system. And we see all these narrow ringlets. And, of course, everybody said, well, they can name one of the rings after me. It's okay, So everybody was happy with that system situation. But it's still not quite understood why the system breaks down in that way. But at any rate, there's more physics going on. The satellites at least cause the outer boundaries. You've got this 2-to-1 resonance, 7-to-6 resonance, and so forth. Yes. We want to see how that happens.
So in earthly granular systems, electrical charges play a role. Is there net charging by the collisions here?
There is. We have very little information about the electromagnetic environment. The suspicion is electromagnetic forces are important on the tiniest dust grains in isolated parts of the rings, but not in the main ring system. You need a hell of a charge to move around something 10 meters in size. So, okay. Yeah.
So is the ring system stable? That's just a long term.
Look, can you ask me that in a bit, if you don't mind? I mean, the thing is that there is the ring system. It depends on how globally you talk about that. If we start to look at these big moons as being big ring particles, then they're able to hold back the system. But everything evolves very slowly, and eventually the system would dissipate. This process would go on forever. If it went on forever, you would get to a ring system that no longer had collisions, and therefore stop evolving, but instead we stop it. Okay, so we're not moving as fast as I'd hope, but nonetheless. Okay, next, we left orbit description to soon. I want to talk about one other aspect of this, and I'm going to use this extra board over here, and that's the idea of epicycle. So What do I mean by an epicycle? What I would like you to start thinking about is that when I look at this motion like so on a nice ellipse, I'd prefer you to think of that motion as instead a motion on a circular path with an oscillation around that circular path. Okay, if I sit in the mean circular orbit and watch the motion of this particle, what happens, of course, is that it starts out at its lowest height here. It's moving faster, and so what it ends up doing is going through what's called an epicycle, a motion that looks like that. Okay, and this would be the centered distance, the average r. Okay, so every orbit, particle goes in, comes back out, goes in, back out, goes back and forth, same period, but it's the orbital period. If I've got my friend here on an inclined path, it goes, starts high, goes low, goes high, goes up and down like this. So I wish I could do it, but I can't, could never even do that. There are three oscillators in this system, right? Because I've got this vertical motion, I've got a radial motion, and a transverse motion. And it turns out those oscillators in the first cut all have the orbital period, right? Because they're all going around the same time. But if you have a closed path, it's got to be the same frequency. But in point of fact, you can believe, I think, without too much trouble, that these frequencies differ a little bit. But because look at this guy going up and down. He's up here. He's actually feeling a little bit more downward force than he should because of this oblateness. And so he's a little bit faster as an oscillator than this guy in and out. So I've got three distinct frequencies in the system. That's interesting. It's interesting, especially, I'm not only a professor of astronomy, I'm in a department of theoretical mechanics as well. You get a harmonic oscillator, you're in business. You can keep a whole department going for 10 years. A couple of harmonic oscillator equations. This is a harmonic oscillator galore because it's a nonlinear system, right? This is not a spring force. It's got higher order terms because it's an expansion over 1 over r squared force. So it's a nonlinear triple harmonic oscillator. What's forcing the system to say there are satellites out here? Those satellites also have three frequencies. And it's nonlinear. So you can multiples of these things. You've got resonances all over the place. The only question is which ones are you going to populate? Right? And keep in mind, this system is great, again, if you're in a mechanics equation, or in a mechanics department, because of the rings, you've got a continuum of frequencies. Right? The system goes from an orbital period of 5 hours to 10 hours. And all those frequencies in between are populated, essentially. Mm-hmm. So you can, set off waves and everything else. Okay, so that's the message on harmonic oscillators and orbit description, global structure. Okay. When do you want me to leave? End. Quarter of an hour. Okay. I'm going to take off and get my shorts in, I think. It's going to have to be faster. Do the following thought experiment with you, and I won't do the equations just because I'd rather show you some pretty pictures toward the end. So here's the thought experiment I'd like to do with you. But the equations are quite simple, so you could do this. Maybe we'll have it as a homework, a class assignment. You could do this, I'm sure. So imagine I'm a little moon like so, and I watch the particle go past me like so. Okay? And if I'm my little moon, this particle moving along the circular path doesn't even know the little moon is there. until it gets quite close. And when it gets quite close, of course, it's pulled forward and pulled outward. And so over the course of time, what you might expect to see is this thing getting pulled out, being tugged on it by the moon. In other words, you've got your circular velocity like so, and you get a radial tug on outward. So what does that do? It changes the circular orbit into an elliptical orbit. Okay? So what you do again, essentially, go back to our harmonic oscillator, as this thing goes by, you hit it, and it goes boom, 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 boom. How long it goes boom, boom, boom? How far does it go in that oscillation? Well, that oscillation is an orbital period. It goes 3 pi delta A. Okay, so what I should expect to see here is then something looks like that. And by how big this wiggle is, I can say how massive the satellite is. And I guess that's all I want to say. Of course, in the other case, if I were looking at a particle which sits outside on a circular path, then the same process goes on. The only difference is that I get a tug in. And so I have a path for the outer one that looks like this. And of course, there's nothing unique about this one object. So if I have a boundary here, I'll end up with a curvy boundary. The streamline of just all these particles doing exactly the same thing. Okay, so let me show you a couple of pretty pictures now. Yeah, please.
The width of the region that's cleaned out by the satellite, similar to the period of the oscillation?
I'm going to tell you, wait one more time if you don't mind, and then I will answer that question. See, he's educable. Hit the left button this time rather than the other one. Okay, so let's show a couple of pretty pictures. Yes. This is to answer David's question. That's an edge on of the ring. And you can see again, this sun is from below and shining up top. We're going to be looking now at this gap, the Encke gap, and that outer one, the Keeler gap. And you can't see it here, but there's a narrow ring that sits out here, the F ring, that we'll also be talking about in a bit. Oops.
It doesn't look like it's a line.
It's just the perspective in that circle. So this is what we just talked about. All right. So we have, a characteristic wiggle to tell us how far away the thing is. That the problem to us, we've got orbits that are three-body orbits, stable orbits in the same path as the satellite. And we should expect to see something like that. I'd like to call to your attention that because, of course, as you move further and further away from the satellite, the wavelength increases, that you would get sort of a moiré pattern developing. Clumping, rarefactions, clumping, rarefactions, so forth and so on.
I guess the objects are orbiting the hour. What is that?
Everybody's going this way at 30 kilometers a second. But relatively, these things are drifting very slowly past, like so. Whoops. Like so. Okay. So now I take you back to an image. Whoops, it's a different image. Here we go. This is that narrow Keeler gap seen at the outer edge of the A-ring. We found a small moon sitting in it, right there. And there we are. And here's a simulation of a million particles trying to duplicate that motion. Give them a little eccentricity, and you don't get these nice sinusoids, you get cusps and so forth. Seems like we're in pretty good shape. We're understanding the process a bit.
Do you understand the damping scale for those waves?
Again, give me two slides and I'll have you have something for you. So this is the same. Now you can understand this inner edge. Okay? And these are those moiré patterns. Okay? These are different beasts that I hope to get to in the next minute. Okay, back to yours. What are the damping scale? Here is looking at the inner edge of the ring, of the gap, and looking at the outer edge of the gap, and here is the location of the satellite. So what you see, the stuff here, I reverse direction, I apologize, particle comes in on the edge, hits the satellite, gets that nice sinusoidal 3 pi delta A oscillation, see a nice damping, presumably it's collisions, you know. We are so smart. We understand this whole thing. And then you look longer, and you see coming around 10 months later, these things are moving very slowly relative to one another. 10 months later, guy's still bouncing up and down. Not quite the same period. Got sort of chirps, comes in here with these funny structures. Boom, then it suddenly goes back into the right period. We have no clue what's going on. Okay? And that's important. It's not important that we don't have any clue. It's important that we don't understand this process. Because after all, it's this process that transfers angular momentum in the system. It's this process that sets the time scale in the system. Okay? Here's another. This is a detail. This is the thing we just looked at. This is another narrow ring outside. It's got two satellites, a satellite on either side. Here's one of them. You can see the damage it's doing to the ring system. It's got the 3 pi delta A, but all sorts of much more complicated stuff going on in this system. Probably there are embedded moonlets. But we can watch, again, we've got movies now, and you can see one of the movies right here of the two shepherds as they move past and how they damage things, but sometimes this thing breaks into 3 or 4 pieces. Don't have a clue what's going on.
I don't have a clue, it means you can't simulate it.
Can't simulate it, don't know the physics. There's some other process. So one more thing that's of interest. You know, of course, I guess I haven't said it, I should, while I'm at it, quickly again, for lack of time, I won't give you all the details, but I can give you at least the basic idea, which is that as this particle moves past and gets tugged inward, keep in mind that as it gets tugged inward, there's work being done on that orbit as it's pulled forward, right? And there's work being done against that orbit as it moves on the other side. And because of this asymmetry, the work done on the far side is more than the work done on the near side. Right? Because this guy is a little bit closer over here than it was over here. What that does is it slows this thing down, the edge moves in. So you've got a mechanism for shepherding. And that is what we think is going on in the system that allows, so this comes back to your question, is what sets the size of that gap. And if we look at those two gaps, our mass scaling seems to be about right for the little gap that the first one I showed you compared to the second one. We seem to be doing okay there. We also might expect that if we put in an object that were not big enough, then it would, if we're not big enough, it wouldn't be able to open a gap. What we'd end up with is something that looks like this. You know, the diffusion. What you should be thinking, of course, is that this process is putting a torque on the system. Simultaneously, there's a viscous torque here, and this boundary is set by the competition between the viscous torque here and the torque set by the exterior body. So big guys will make bigger holes, but if I get something small enough, I open the gap, but then it closes behind me. And that's a simulation on the left. and here are some things that we've seen now in the rings. They look pretty ratty, but we got excited about them. They're exactly what the simulation shows. The two little lines, and we found, this is one of these standard tales of the physicists, I think, where we were about a year and a half into the mission and sitting down in front of a TV screen with my postdoc, and he said, we just haven't seen anything. He said, yeah, look, I'll show you. We don't see anything. We saw these two little, this is like Morse code for there's a little satellite sitting in the middle. And we now have some 150 of these objects in, that presumably tell us. We do that by looking at the simulation. We know what the viscosity is. So these things are we're not at surfboard size. We're now at good yacht size, maybe football field size, something like that. I'm going to just rush through the very end of this. So here are some of these structures that are produced. And let me just, in 2 minutes, remind you again that what we have is we have a buildup in certain, you know, concentrations and rarefactions due to this moiré-like pattern. And exactly the same thing will happen, I'll back off, at discrete locations. So here is the orbit of a series of particles that are almost going at twice as fast as the exterior satellite. Okay, and what's going to happen now, remember, you're at a 2-to-1 resonance here, so that will mean the amplitude will be big. As you move away from that exact exact resonance, you're going to get smaller and smaller amplitudes. You get a phase shift like in a simple harmonic oscillator, and what ends up is that this structure, right at that location and just beyond, develops a spiral pattern. A 2-arm spiral for this 2-to-1 resonance, 3-arm spiral for a 3-to-1 resonance, and so forth. And of course, if you were a little particle in this system, you would have this sweep past you, that mass distribution. And so what you've got is your it's exactly the same process. And if you have, so if the system is sensitive to that frequency, and of course it is, because that's why it started there. It's a 2-to-1 resonance. So you're pushing it at just what it wants to be pushed at. And so you get a majestic.
No one's ever seen a 3-to-1 spiral pattern.
No. We've got, you know, 8-to-5. We've got hundreds of these things. And the nice thing is, of course, how the wavelength at which they propagate, and you see it here, turns out to be dependent upon the, so here are some, we now do nice wavelets, run across these, do wavelets, we can get nice frequencies. The frequencies are connected with the mass density in the ring. We've got probes of the ring. We're able to get viscosities in the ring by how fast these things damp out. We've got an ability to watch this whole angular momentum transport go on. What do we find? We find, unfortunately, or fortunately, he just hired that, that the time scale seems, again, about 20 times too fast, unless the ring is very, very young. And again, that plays back into the whole protoplanetary disk thing because we want to know time scales. I'm not going to do that. I'm going to just end with that and say a couple of final remarks about what we've learned.
That's a moon?
That's one of the moons sitting above the ring. So we're seeing many of the processes that take place in our local astrophysical disks that also take place in protoplanetary disks around other stars. We're seeing angular momentum transport clearly take place. We're hoping to be able to actually pick up the motion of some of these small satellites so that we can get a time scale from that. We're seeing gaps be opening up. We're watching the way big bodies evolve. We're seeing the accumulation of and breakup of bodies within the ring system. We have an accessible laboratory, and the question is we've got to make use of our last few years in orbit to be able to ask the right questions, run the right experiments while we're there, and NASA keeps funding. Thanks very much.
Well, are there any more? I have
Why, if the time scale is this, it's been around for billions of years, must have been.
We don't know. I mean, it's possible. There are scenarios that say the rings formed by the breakup of a satellite that tidally evolved inward, or a nearby comet that passed by and broke up. But then you've got to within 100 million years, and then you have to say, well, is that really very plausible? Because the solar system was much more violent back, you know, at the beginning of time, and so it's not very plausible. But the alternative is, I'm not sure, you know, we don't.
So you really, you have a two orders of magnitude problems with time scale.
Mm-hmm.
The other question is, I mean, our solar system is another disk system.
Mm-hmm.
It's disappeared by a long time.
It has disappeared, but there are still remnants of this sort of stuff. If you look at the asteroid belt, for instance, there are lots of resonant gaps in the system. There's a truncation at the 2-to-1 resonance.
But isn't that an argument that the time scale might be shorter again?
Yeah, I think so. I think we should be looking for shorter timescales and more plausible ways than to make rings in short timescales.
Yeah. I guess it must have been a long time ago. I heard you talk about rings, and that was sort of very much in the context of dynamical systems ideas, and it was all periodic versus chaotic orbits and Kolmogorov torus, etc., etc. So what happened? You didn't seem to mention any of those ideas. What happened to them?
Well, they're certainly out there. But you know, I think over the past 20 years, many people have come to say, you know, it used to be, say, in the late 70s, early 80s, somebody said, chaos. And said, chaos, it's chaos! Now he said, it's chaos. No, big deal. Yeah. It's a chaotic orbit. There's lots of overlapping resonances, but so on.
That's a question of time scale. You're now doing observations on very short time.
Yes, for sure. But there is, you know, like this satellite that surround this Ephraim, they're on chaotic orbits and they jump back and forth between resonances. We don't think it makes any difference, but we really don't know. I don't know if that addresses your question.
I guess my understanding back then was that the issue was sort of remaining a Kolmogorov tori, sort of partitioning the phase space and actually being responsible for some of those sharp boundaries. Right, because if there are such sharp bounds, so if you say that your viscosity is ultimately of chaotic origin,
mm-hmm.
rather than thermal, then you know, one extra tidbit it gives you is that chaos has actually knows about order hiding there, and actually may know of you know, restore that it actually has to preserve. So I thought the point there was to explain some of the sharpness by...
There is one group in Israel that has that view. Most people don't take the view instead that it's this boundary by resonances with nearby satellites.
Can you actually calculate that 10-meter boundary there?
No.
So what are the simulations you're producing?
No. No, to my knowledge, they do not. I mean, the thing is, you've got a long time for that system before it comes back under the direct control of the satellite. It's a surprise that it's facing the MIMO.
Yeah.
I
was wondering what inhibits higher order resonance in more complex spiral arms in the galactic systems. I mean, as David said, you don't see three arms or four arms.
I don't know the answer to that. I think that a major role, you know, the major difference between the ring systems and the galaxy is the fact that we have so little mass in our system, that our rings are very tightly wound. That's one difference. The other difference is we have a very early object that splits the resonances. Maybe that makes a difference, but I really don't know the answer to the question.
Is there a different time scale for forming the 2-to-1 versus the 3-to-1?
Yes, there. That's been shown in analytical work for the asteroid belt. I'm sure it's
true. Is that possibly contributing to this fact that we don't see the 3 to one for the galaxies or something?
Could be. I don't know. I'm sorry.
What explains the differences in the ring system between the systems between the major planets?
Well,
is it just initial conditions?
Most people would say initial conditions, so can't say for events. Some would say, we know, for instance, in the case of the Durbin system, the rain there is generally believed to be produced by the debris coming off these small moons. And there are a couple of embedded moons that supply the rain system and then pop it up and so forth and so on. And it could be that the Saturn system is a similar process, but with a very major source. One thing we're trying to do right now is to figure out exactly what is the mass of the ring system. I quoted you 10 to the minus 6 and 10 to the minus 7, but it turns out that we're now understanding that the section of the ring, the ring, is much denser than we thought and could be that it's hiding a lot more mass.
But I heard one of the best buying models for the solar system, like Jupiter and Saturn, so they got very close together in the world. I think when they graduated in detail, one or two resonance, there's a whole lot of junk going around. We may have acquired the same amount of junk, right? In that picture?
I mean, that's the satellites and the satellite systems themselves are quite different, so I would have to say.
And then the satellites clean one out and clear the other one.
Marty, you have a question?
No.
Okay, well, let's thank you again.